Greetings to all of God's people. This is again Mordecai Joseph, 1-9, lesson 234. And in the last lesson, we were in verse 9 of chapter 21, speaking about servants, hired servants from God's point of view, not slaves in the sense of the world, but servants who are only slaves to God. In other words, slaves of God, workers of God, servants of God. But as far as his own people, he in essence forbade them, and we shall read these laws, to ever have a slave of their own people of Israel, unless somebody of his own free will has basically said that he wants to be with his master forever. But even then, God said, only until the Jubilee. And by the way, last time I think I made a mistake there, confusing two laws there, in terms of the servants, and when do they go? After 6 years. Or when they are, according to their own, that is, by their own free will, decide to stay there with the master. And I say that they are going to leave the master, or are going to be sent free by the master in the death of the high priest. Well, actually, it's not the death of the high priest. It's when the Jubilee arrives, and with the death of the high priest, the other law was for people who murder by mistake, whatever it may be, or even if they've taken vengeance and others are chasing them, and they go and flee into the city of refuge, and while there, and assuming that what they've done was not contrary to the law of God, and therefore they have to stay there until the death of the high priest. So I was just mixing these two laws together. Sometimes when you speak fast, you forget a couple of things there, and pretty soon you're saying something you should not be saying until you listen to it, and then you realize, no, that's not what I meant. Anyway, I think that gives us a clue sometimes why some of the apostles and the servants of God have recorded certain things that are not exactly correct, and there are certain statements like that by the different apostles who quoted certain facts that were not necessarily correct, and apparently if they had the chance to edit what they were saying, they would have realized, no, that's not what I meant, but by then it was already recorded and sent away, and God preserved it in the Bible. And that's basically probably why we have sometimes discrepancies in some details, and there are certain statements like that, all of us may be familiar with it, here and there, by apostles and prophets. Anyway, let's make that correction now and continue from this point. And then in verse 10, now we continue, in terms of the son, you see the master has this maid now that the father in essence is selling to him. And as we explained that earlier, it is a matter of contract. It is a matter of a father that cannot afford, or for whatever reason, you know, he's selling his daughter. In today's terminology, we call it he's hiring her for a job. You know, he's sending her to, in other words, he takes her to an employer and he said, would you give my daughter a job? And, you know, we're going to sign here a contract for 6 years, which is the normal period of time. And you can have her. And if you want to marry her, fine. You know, if your son wants to marry her, fine. If not, you know, she might marry somebody else in your household. And if not, just, you know, for 6 years, she's going to be with you. And after that, according to the law, obviously, she'll go free. And that's in essence the way the law was, and it was always within the context of the family, the extended family at least. And so in verse 9, let's read again, and if he's speaking about the master, if he espouses her, that's the one, the maiden, which would be obviously a relative, unto his son, he shall deal with her after the manner of the daughters. In other words, just like every daughter, she reaches the age of marriage, and then she marries someone. And when she does, obviously, there are laws that govern that relationship, and that's in essence what he's saying here. That's the way he's going to have to treat her, and not just because she was hired for 6 years, he's going to mistreat her, and, you know, like a second citizen person, and she's not, you know, second-class citizen, that is. And so in verse 10, God now makes it very plain. What is he supposed to do in terms of this daughter that he had taken as a wife either for himself or for his son? And in essence, we're going to read now the first law of divorce here and the conditions for it. under what conditions a divorce should occur. Verse 10, if he take him another wife, which was a part of the law, and you know, some people don't realize that, you know, today we're talking about bigamy, or polygamy, and all those things. Those are not biblical realities, they're just not. And even the Jews to this very day realize that, even though by the civil law, which the nation is governed, and not by the nation of Israel is not governed by the Torah, it's governed by the civil law, but the religious community has a tremendous also input into it, and many of the laws are also based on the Torah. And they realize that bigamy is not unbiblical, polygamy is not unbiblical, but they forbid it, as they began to do it in Second Temple time. And the reason for it was, well, people were not taking care of their wives as they should be, and that created problems within the family, and they didn't look favorably upon that. So in essence, some rabbis, because of all the problems that they were having, they literally forbid the community to do it. But he also, at the same time, realizes that, and so does everybody else, this is not a biblical injunction. It is what they call the halachic injunction from the halacha. The halacha was the rabbinic code of law. And so we have to understand the differences between the two. And that's in essence when rabbinic Judaism rose during that time and began gradually to take hold of the whole community. And it is the very way of life by which they are governed. It's not as much the Torah as it is the halakha, the rabbinic code of law. But biblically, to this very day, they still admit it. The Bible never, never forbids more than one wife, and therefore they cannot call it bigamy or polygamy, biblically speaking, but they can call it that way and prosecute someone for that based on the civil law of the land, which is backed by the rabbis to begin with. And so let's realize that from God's point of view. And you know, when the government of the land forbids that, we basically should shy away from it to begin with. That creates problems, and that's not ideal, even though God allowed it. But at the same time, by the same token, we should realize, conversely, it is not a sin. It is not anti-biblical, and it is not a polygamy or a bigamy when it comes to the Bible. There is no such a thing there, you know, as bigamy or polygamy. God allowed it, and you see many laws here where God made it very plain that more than one wife was not forbidden. And most of the Israelites, as a matter of fact, had more than one wife, had several ones. Now look at all the kings of Israel, and, you know, King David, righteous king, and many wives that he had, and God told him when he was messing around with somebody else's wife, he said that was the problem. Bathsheba, you know, the wife of Uriah the Hittite, and God basically told him, you know, if he wanted more wives, I would have given you more. You see, why do you have to go after somebody's married woman? And that was the problem there. So you can see, you know, way down the road, you know, God is not against polygamy or bigamy. People who can handle it, can afford it. After all, you're talking about a farming society where if a husband has only one wife, you know, he has only one son and he's not doing well on the farm. He needs a lot of employees, a lot of workers. And that was their way of doing it, you know, having more than one wife. It was not necessarily just because of desire, but it was a necessity of the time. Nowadays, obviously, you don't need it. But let's look, you know, on every law and every teaching that we see from the point of view of God, not the point of view of men. Even though he created Adam and Eve, one wife, one husband, and that's the ideal. But reality is, unfortunately, because we depart from God and things are different, are changing, and therefore God is, in essence, making up for it. And so this is what we read here. If he take to himself another wife, her food, her raiment, and her conjugal rights, in other words, her sexual needs, and that includes not only you know, the sex act itself, but also affection, you see, and flirting, you know, everything that goes with it, and courting. You know, every woman needs that, every man needs that. So this goes both ways. You see, if a woman denies her husband these three things, and of course she's not, under the old system, she was not the one responsible to feed him and clothe him, but she's responsible, you know, for taking, you know, taking care of the house and all kind of things like that. And obviously, having children, having sex and affection and all that. So, you know, this is the law of God that goes both ways. It's not just one way, even though it is recorded in this way here. God is not a respecter of persons. So if a man takes another wife, and of course some women can say today, well, how come, you know, if the man takes another wife, another woman doesn't, cannot take another husband? Well, It never worked that way for all kind of reasons. And this is what we read here. But one husband, several wives, just sort of, you know, one rooster, you know, several hen, and so forth. That's the way it goes in nature, not in Jordan, not the other way around. But aside from why is it this way or why is it that way, you know, that's between us and God. When we meet Him, we'll find out all these things. Until then, let's just read it for what it says. And if he take him another wife, her food and her raiment and her conjugal rights shall he not diminish. So, three conditions. And basically, every man and every woman in Israel could have gone to the elders. You see, the elders of their family. They didn't need to go to the minister like we do today. This is the last resort. Unfortunately, as time developed, the church began to take over where God never gave them authority. And they began to govern the private life of the family where they never had an authority either, you see. And then they take it for granted that they had the authority and it came from God, and it's a big lie. And unfortunately, many of us are subject to it without even realizing it. And we think that it's up to the minister to marry and to bury, and it's not. He has no right to be in that office, you know, and God didn't give us that office. And when we said during the marriage ceremony, "But the authority which has invested in me by the court of heaven," this is one absolute big lie. You see, that's not from God. No priest ever married anybody in Israel. No Levi has ever done it. No rabbi has ever done it. You see? Until gradually things began to change and the clergy began to take authority and insert itself where it didn't belong and enslave the people in the process and come between them and God. You know, that's what we have today. When we think about the marriages today, a lot of people don't realize that. Roughly about 600 years ago, there was no marriage performed by the priesthood in terms of the Catholic or the Protestant world. You see, at that time, 600, we're talking only about the Catholic. There was no Protestants, but they came later. They just followed the example of the Catholics. The priesthood was not involved in it. You know, the clergy was not involved in it. They knew that's not their business. They knew that's in the Bible. It's not their business. It's between the parents of both bride and bridegroom, and they struck the deal. And they just put them together and they had the wedding supper. That's all they have, a wedding supper. You see? Moses was not the priest, you know, marrying Israel and God. You see? And he was just there as a witness to ratify in terms of the sacrifice. And that was also why. Because Israel was not willing to listen directly to her husband. So they said, "We want you, Moses, to come in between us." You see? But that was not an appointment that God gave him. It is because the people rejected God's direct relationship with them. That's basically the way it developed. But even then, you know, even with the priesthood and all that, God, you know, He gave them certain responsibilities, but not to interfere within the lives of the family. Now, if the family wanted to go to the priest for whatever reason, that's something else. But the priest had no business, you know, entering into the family and telling them how to conduct their lives. They had to come to him. He didn't go to them. So it was also for tithing, you see, and so forth. Well, anyway, just a side point here. And so basically, you know, there are three things here that must be there within the marriage. And the reality is, unfortunately, that both husbands and wives are transgressing this. Oftentimes, many are, not everybody, but many do, the majority do. And that creates a lot of problems within the family. And that also created a lot of problems for those people who had more than one wife. In other words, favoring one and didn't care much about the other. And they were not taking care of her needs. And to begin with, when a man has too many wives, he's not going to be able to do it anyway. And that's that becomes, you know, a part that is contrary to the law. Because he has to, by law, take care of these three major aspects of the relationship. And he cannot take somebody and just keep her in prison. You know, that's basically what marriage becomes when you don't take care of all these matters wholeheartedly with all of your being and heart, just like you would have a relationship with God. There's nothing that you are allowed to withhold from God, and therefore that, you know, is the same thing also in our human relationships, and there are laws that govern our relationships. We have no right to see the poor and not care for them. We have no right, you see, to see sick people and not care for them. We are by law are commanded to do those things. And so obviously within the marriage it ought to be even more, much more so. So this goes again both ways. So either a husband, if he had a wife like that who denied him, sexual rights or affection or whatever it may be, was not willing to take care of the house, take care of the children, well, he could put her away. And if the wife found herself in that position, she could go to the elders, and the elders would basically, bring a separation there between the two. And so in this case, God is dealing with it in terms of the maid that was given to a son while she is during that period of time of a hired servant. And so this is what God is saying. And verse 11, and if he do not these three things unto her, and goes both ways, if this is not done, well, this is the law. Then she shall go out for nothing without money. You see? Then she can go out for free. In other words, the divorce occurs at that point, and she is free to remarry. And that's basically what it is. It's a law of divorce. And obviously, in this case, we're not even dealing with the question of fornication, as later on Jesus Christ would specify that marriages should not come apart except for fornication. But then he was dealing with that issue of fornication there, you see. And some people think, well, that's the only exception that he's talking about. Well, the matter there was marriages that are not being taken care of in terms of immorality. And what about these laws that he himself gave? This is Jesus Christ giving these laws, and he's not contradicting himself, you see. Down there, he's just dealing with a certain aspect of the law there, and not with this aspect here. And so some people do not study the entirety of the law that Jesus Christ himself gave from Sinai, and therefore they think, well, we've got a new law in the New Testament. No, we don't. It's the same law by the same person. All proceeded down from the Father, you see. And he is Christ himself. He's the one that said, don't think that I came to destroy the Torah or the prophets, until heaven and earth pass away, not one jot or one tittle shall pass from the law. You see? No, so this is true. Then turning around and saying, that that's the only exception is fornication, will be a contradiction of his own law, of his own word. So you say, where is it right? Is it here or is it there? When he studied the entirety of the matter, then he began to have a greater understanding. When he's speaking about a certain area, this is where he put the emphasis there on the fornication. But obviously, a man or a woman who are not willing to fulfill the responsibilities there, you see, even Paul, as he said later on about their wives or their husbands who are not willing to dwell in peace with you, well, let them go because, a brother or sister are not under obligation in this case. What is he talking about? About this very law that we are reading right here. You see? If a man and a woman are not willing to take care of their responsibilities within the marriage, just like it was with the marriage with God. God says, if you will obey my laws and commandments, then I will do this and this and that. Well, what happens when you don't? Well, he told them also when you don't, I'm going to throw you out. Oh yes, he hates divorce, and he hated putting Israel away, but he did it anyway. You see? And so let's understand the whole matter there. And unfortunately, when we do not study the whole law, then, we invent our own doctrines and our own understanding. And we think that we know the law of God, and we don't. So we know partially the law of God, but not the entirety of it as we should. That comes only from the constant, as David would do, constant study of the law of God day and night. And then you understand the whole picture, and when to deal with a matter in this manner and when to deal with it in a different manner. Anyway, let's continue verse 12. He that smites a man, now he goes to another law here. He that smites a man so that he dies shall surely be put to death. No if, yes, and but. You see, no debate about death penalty, and as people are debating it back and forth today, that may be very plain. That's the law of God, and this law has not changed to this very day. Now, obviously, within the body of Christ, we're not given that right to put somebody to death. But the reality is, God is going to take care of that matter. And we see that even in the New Testament, when Ananias and Sapphira were cheating, pretending like they're giving, you know that account in the book of Acts. In essence, the death penalty was being passed by Peter on them. You see? Because they, in essence, were stealing. Even though they were giving it away, but the mere fact that they were lying about it, that was like stealing. Because they kept a part of it, and yet they claimed that they gave it all. And so Peter told them, why do you tempt the Holy Spirit? So we don't have the power, yes, but God does. And when he chooses to, he executes the death penalty. And this law was not done away with. It's just the administration of it was changed. We're not the one administering it, but God does. And in that case, he chose to do it publicly, and the whole community knew about it, and they feared, and they had greater respect for God and his apostles and the law of God. You see, that's against the law to do that, to bear false witness, and in the process stealing money even though it's yours. So let's not think, that we have a new law in the New Testament. It is the same thing, just a different administration. And so God makes it very plain. You smite a man and he dies, you are going to be put to death, and that's all there is to it. In other words, think about it before you do it. Verse 13, and if a man lie not in wait, but God caused it, or the Elohim, caused it to come to hand. In other words, if he was not really plotting, no planning, but in today's terminology, we say time and chance. It just happened to be like that. But the mere fact that God himself used this terminology, that he himself was involved in it, that means that God is the one that sometimes is involved in the killing of someone and is creating circumstances, you see, to bring it about. And that's why the statement is in this way. You see, God is the one dictating it. Jesus Christ is the one dictating it. And he is the one that is saying that he himself, the Elohim, caused it to come to hand. In other words, he wanted somebody dead. And so he created a circumstance for somebody else to kill him without even intending to do it. You see? So God has many ways of destroying someone that is not pleasing in his sight. And so this is what we read here. But if he didn't do, he didn't lie in wait, he wasn't plotting, he wasn't planning, but God caused it to come to hand, then I will appoint you a place where there he may flee. And later on, if you remember, in the case of King David, when he was being chased by King Saul all the time, and at a certain point he found him in a cave, and another point he found him in a different place, and his own friends that were with him, with David, they told him, hey, here's your chance to kill that king that was after you, and God, God made it possible for you to do it, because he created the circumstance where you can really kill him. You see? Well, the circumstance was being created, but you cannot kill the Lord's anointed, and David realized that. And he told them, it may be of God, but there are limitations to what God allows us to do. In this case, even though the circumstances were created, God does not want me to do it. And in essence, God was testing him. Would he disobey the law of God, which basically told us, you do not revile the king, and you do not smite the king, and many things like that. And so God was involved in either case. And especially with his own people. His eye is constantly upon his own people and their actions, our actions, our thoughts, our feelings and emotions, and he's creating all kinds of circumstances to fulfill his will one way or the other. And so we should realize that and not think that God is on vacation and we can do whatever we want, and husbands can abuse wives and wives can abuse their husbands and abusing children, brethren, friends and so forth, and smite one another and go to court, and speak evil of one another, and we think we can do all that with impunity, and we don't realize, as Jesus Christ made it very plain, you better be careful. Don't offend anyone, because the angels are watching everything. They're reporting to God everything that we're doing to each other. You see? He warned us against it, and a lot of people obviously totally forgot that, and the law of God is not on their mind. And they're not thinking about these kind of things, and they continue to transgress the law of God in so many ways and hurt one another, and they don't realize all those things that are being recorded and brought before the Father, and when the time comes, one way or the other, we're going to pay for it. Nobody's going to get scot-free with it, so let's not mock God, and on the other hand, let's realize we don't need to take vengeance ourselves. God is recording everything, in due time he's going to take care of it, and that's why he said, vengeance is mine, I will repay. Well, here is one case where God was going to repay someone by creating the circumstance for him to be killed by somebody else who did not even mean to do it. Sort of an accident. Well, was it really an accident? Verse 14. If a man, well, here it is. In this case, he said, if God caused it to come to hand, then I will appoint you a place where he may flee. And you see, this is the case where we mentioned earlier, where I was mixing two laws there, not thinking clearly. There he's going to stand till the death of the high priest. And after that, he's allowed to go and go back to his home. Verse 14, and if a man come presumptuously upon his neighbor to slay him with guile, you shall take him for my altar, that he may die. You see, because the law, as it developed later on, was that if somebody's after you and you ran to the temple, to the tabernacle, you know, later on, this is what the people call the, you know, safety of the sanctuary, and people used to flee into churches because when they did, then people wouldn't, you know, come after them, because that was a sanctity, you know, a sanctified domain, and nobody could go in and fetch anybody from the church once they flee into that place. That became, you know, the property of God. So, you know, from this law, this is basically where it came from. But God said, a person like that, who is that kind of a person, even if he goes and holds on the horns of the altar, even from there you can take him. And that's in essence what King Solomon later on did with Joab. You see, because Joab did kill many people presumptuously, like Abner and others. And David basically told Solomon, you know, you're a wise man, you know how to deal with this man, even though he was his own nephew. Imagine that. Joab was a nephew of David, and yet David realized that the man deserved the death penalty. Because of his, even though he served him faithfully, he also was wicked in many areas. And so he went hiding, you know, in the temple, and he was holding on the altar. Of course, at the time it was not the temple, it was the tabernacle, but it was in Jerusalem, and he wouldn't come out. So God, that is Solomon, told basically his servant, you know, his the one that he sent to fetch him, you go kill him right there. And that's what he did. And so this is where we see this law here. A person like that, even when he goes and holds on the horns of the altar, even there you can take him from and kill him. Verse 15, and he that smites his father or his mother shall be surely put to death. Oh, how many kids are doing it nowadays? How many kids not only smiting, you know, the father and mother, you know, which is, you know, just raising your hand, but how many people do it verbally? Or even that, there was a law against it. And we're going to read these things, because what we're dealing here with is, remember, as we said in the ten oracles that God gave, after him, you see, the ultimate in the life of all of us, then comes the father and the mother. You see, they're secondary in chain of authority. Not somebody coming in between, you know, the priest or the rabbi or anybody else. But the father and the mother are to the children like God, like the father, the one that became the father in Jesus Christ. And so you smite, you know, you raise your hand to smite God, well, the penalty is death. You know, and people should realize that. And unfortunately, a lot of kids nowadays, you know, have no respect for their parents. They're taught by the society to respect and disrespect their parents. And some people literally smite their own father and mother. God says, you know, very plainly, you know, you don't take him through a psychiatric evaluation and rehabilitation and all that. God says, kill him. Simple as that. And all the other kids are going to hear about it, and how many people we want to do it. Verse 16, and he that steals a man, kidnapping, and sells him, or if he be found in his hand, he shall surely be put to death. So whether he sold him or not, he's going to be put to death. A lot of people used to do that. As a matter of fact, an awful lot of the slaves that were brought into this country were basically, a lot of them, not all of them, many of them were just taken in as prisoners of war, you know, by feuding tribal clans there, you know, different ones that were going to war against each other. And the prisoners were sold to traders, and oftentimes most of those traders were Arabs, and they used to sell them to Europe and the Americas and other islands, whatever it may be. And in many cases, they literally used to go and kidnap them and then sell them as slaves. And God says, anybody who is sold under this condition is going to be put to death. And so God is going to deal with a lot of those people in the resurrection. You know, we're not allowed to do a thing like that. And so God makes it very plain. Verse 18, and if men contend and one smite the other with a stone or with his fist, in other words, he intended to do him harm, violence, and he die not, but keep his bed. If he rises again and walks abroad, in other words, he's not in bed where he cannot get up. So if he walks around but walks abroad upon his staff, then shall he that smote him be quit. In other words, he's not going to be put to death. Only he shall pay for the loss of his time and shall cause him to be thoroughly healed. As God says, and that's the law of God that, you know, we mentioned earlier, you read in Deuteronomy, God says, I smite and I also heal. I kill and I also make alive. You see, that's the nature of God. And so God is a responsible God. You see, he doesn't just smite someone, just leaves him there. You know, as we We dealt with it in the section where we brought the seven laws of successful correction. We dealt with this issue here. People unfortunately don't do it. You know, they insult people and they don't go and try to heal the breach, and they just leave them there, you know, wounded, you know, in their own broken feelings, so to speak, broken heart, whatever it may be, hurt feelings. The law of God is, you know, you've done a damage, you go take care of it and you heal it. And that's the nature of God. That's in essence what He's teaching them. Be holy as I am holy. Just be like me. And many of us are not doing it. And especially those among us, you know, writing those articles or speaking evil of one another. Do they ever have the intention? Do they ever do it? Come around and heal the, you know, the hurts that they've caused? Obviously not. And you know, they just don't care about people. Well, they develop a nature of the devil when they behave in that manner. And people like that, sooner or later, they are not repentant of this nature. You see, will be put to death. That's all there is to it. God is not going to allow anybody with a nature like that into His kingdom. So, you know, this is serious business. Even though the death penalty is not anymore in the New Testament, as we read it, that is, you know, within the body of Christ, you know, during this period of 2,000 years, yet God still holds that death penalty over the head of the one that had sinned unless he comes to repentance and makes amends for it. So let's understand that. When we, you know, raise our hand to strike someone, either with our own, you know, hand or our own tongue, you know, verbally, let's realize we're going to have to turn around and do the healing. And if we have no intention of doing it, we better not do it, because the death penalty will be hanging over us. And an awful lot of us are under the death penalty, and we think we are under grace, and we are not. And we don't realize it. And so, this is what God is saying. Be responsible. You cause the damage, you pay the penalty for it, you know. And in the process of doing it, obviously, you're going to be reconciled. You see, you know, you can study this and you can spend an awful lot of time, but obviously we do not want to do it at this point. It's for every single one of us on an individual basis. Take every law, think about it, meditate about it, think about all the ramifications. It will be a good, you know, a great idea for brethren to get together and discuss the law in this matter and bring all the possibilities there, and let man, woman, and child also bring their input, and you will be surprised how rich your fellowship would be if you would do it. You know, how much of the nature and the mind of God you will absorb when you do that, and you will understand also. And the Spirit of God will be there also to inspire. And unfortunately, people are not doing it as they should. They come and just sit down there and listen to a man pontificate about this and that, and he throws a few scriptures here and there sometimes. Other times, it may be more valuable what he says. But in either case, they're not doing what God commanded us to do as we come before Him. You see, come and worship Him, praise Him, honor Him, glorify Him, have the divine service, and also take that time, a measure of time, of the study of the law and the prophets. All of us, you see, not somebody pontificating about it, but the whole congregation literally studies the law and discusses it. And that's the way it was in the temple, and that's the way it was in the synagogue, and that's the way it was when Christ went to the temple, you know. He went over there and discussed it with the doctors of the law many times. But we departed from that, and again, you know, the clergy is the one responsible for it, and to this very day, they are guilty of that, and one of these days, they're going to have to pay the penalty for it, for coming between man and God. As sincere as they may be. Verse 20, and if a man smite his bondman or his bondwoman with a rod, and he die under his hand, he shall surely be punished. And the punishment here did not mention death, but whether it be death, previously it already said, you know, if you do that, you have to pay the penalty of death. But in this case, being his own property, at least during this period of time, we're going to see a little exception there. Verse 21, notwithstanding, if he continue a day or two, he shall not be punished. Whatever the punishment, it's not specified here, but if the previous scriptures are what they're supposed to be, in terms of smiting someone, then the penalty should be death. And so, if he doesn't, just like, you know, we had a previous law here, if the person that you smote didn't die, he still walks around, well, you're responsible to make amends and heal, you know, bring the person to a complete state of wholeness and pay the person and his family in the process, because he cannot work, you know. You pay his wages now. And so here it says, if he stands around, he shall not be punished, for he is his money. And if men strive together with hurt, a woman with child, so that her fruit depart, in other words, the baby is gone, And yet no harm followed beside that. In other words, the mother was not hurt, and no, she didn't die. She wasn't hurt. He shall be surely fined according as the woman's husband shall lay upon him. In other words, people should not get into an altercation of that manner, because God did not set any limit here on what the husband can ask for. You see? He just made the law. According as the woman's husband shall lay upon him. You know, some can say more and some can say less. See, all these things are in essence laws to control the nature of men from running amok, you see, and to help them to think like God, care about one another, love one another. You see, that's a royal law. So all these laws are to teach us, and mind you, all these laws, they're not only in terms of the physical things that we do to each other, they're also in terms of the verbal and emotional and psychological things, because we can smite people day and, you know, all day and all night without even realizing it, with our tongue, with our behavior, with our conduct. You see? And this is just as serious, just like that. And so this is the spirit of the law. And we have to understand that it is still valid to this very day. Nothing of all that was done away with. And so, here it says he's going to pay according to the, whatever the husband should lay upon him. And also got added here another clause to this law, because, you know, some husbands may be extremely greedy and go over and above and beyond. And so there is another check and balance here, and he shall pay as the judges determine. So it's not only the husband, you know, the husband is going to, you know, name a price there, and then the judges will also determine whether it is fair or not. And if it's not too much, the judge would say, okay, you paid. And obviously, if it is too much, the judge would say, well, you've got to come down a little bit, you know, be reasonable. That's unfair. The person cannot afford it, whatever it may be. So, in the case of a rich man, he certainly can pay a lot. And so the judges, you know, will go along with it. But in the case of a person that cannot afford much, it's going to be different there, obviously. And so you can see how God is working on both situations here. He's trying to bridle, in essence, you know, the covetousness that may be there on the part of the husband. And so, verse 23, we read, but if any harm follow, you know, there is damage to the woman, then you shall give life for life. In other words, if he hurt her, you see, to the point where she bled, you know, the baby went and out, you know, and she bled, and bled to death, whatever it may be. So the penalty is going to be equal, he says. Life for life, literally. In other words, he caused her death, he is going to die. He caused the damage to her eye, or anybody's eye, his eye is going to be plucked out. You know, that was the administration of death, of severe punishment. And carnal people, unfortunately, need this kind of law. Otherwise, crime is all over the place. And because justice and judgment are not executed speedily, you know, the proverb would tell us, therefore there is an awful lot of iniquity in the heart of men. And so we see that a huge crime industry that we have nowadays, you know, police and security and all these things, that's because the law of God is not being obeyed. Because when you do that, well, how many people are going to hang around without an eye and without a tooth or a hand or a foot and being dead and still continue to be the way they are? You see, you go to Saudi Arabia where they do it. You see, they're very harsh there. They go literally by these biblical injunctions. And there's very little crime in that country. You see, because people learn lessons the hard way. But then, as God said many times, you do that so that everybody will hear and fear. You see, if they're carnal-minded, well, that's only the way they function. And that's the way, you know, they need to be treated. That's what he's saying. Life for life, eye for an eye, tooth for tooth, and hand for hand, foot for foot, burning for burning, wound for wound, stripe for stripe. You see, that was very plain. And the judges of the land made sure that this penalty will be carried out. Verse 26. I mean, it may sound very, very harsh, but think about it. When if you don't do it, how many people are going to suffer? Much, much, much more. Infinitely much more than if you just taken few people and made an example out of them. You see? And then the rest will hear and fear, and you're not going to see people misbehaving in this manner. And then we read in verse 26, and if a man smite the eye of his bondman or the eye of his bondwoman and destroy it, he shall let him go free for his eye's sake. And if he smite out his bondman's tooth or his bondwoman's tooth, he shall let him or her, that is, go free for his tooth's sake. In other words, just because you are the master and you have a property there in the sense of, you know, property hired servant of the children of Israel, you see, we're in reality they're not really your property, but on a temporary basis, that's sort of your property, just like, you know, we go to the army, we become GIs, you know, government issue. We're in essence the property of the state. And when we go and work for a certain company, to one degree or the other, we are the property. And we have to abide by the rules if we want to get paid. You see, we have more freedom there, you know, we just say, you know, we don't want to work for you anymore, and we take off. That's fine. But if you sign a contract, you see, some contracts, you know, are written in such a way that if you break the contract and you don't want to work for them anymore, well, they can take you to court. And so in one sense, you become their property until the contract is over. And so this is what we're dealing with here. And as long as people are in that relationship, he says to both, you better be responsible and you better watch your actions and you better behave in accordance with my laws, because I'm here to execute vengeance and judgment one way or the other, either through the judges or relatives or whatever it may be, or do it personally. And mind you, God is speaking in essence to his wife. In order for her to become like him and become ultimately a divine wife, well, she has to develop his nature. And this is a part of his nature. This is the nature of Jesus Christ. This is the nature of the Father. This is the nature of every servant of God who is going to be a servant of God for eternity. We cannot go again, you know, go around it. And so many of these things, obviously, you know, the way life is in the past 2,000 years, the body of Christ itself does not have the authority to do it. But the reality is that God is going to take care of it one way or the other. The law is not done away with. The administration of it, you know, is changed. But God is going to make sure that everybody is going to get his just reward. You see, whatever we sow, we shall reap one way or the other. So either we do it literally, physically, or we do it spiritually, emotionally, psychologically, the penalty is the same. And God will make sure that it is executed, and he warned us about it. You see, a man who offends his, you know, a little brother, he says he better be like a man who put a millstone around his, you know, his neck and just dumped himself into the lake. You see? And so he was very, very serious about that warning, and that goes for every single law that we break against our own brother, you know. Kill him, murder him, spiritually, physically, stone him, whatever it may be. There is a penalty for everything that we do, and a blessing for everything that we do. It goes both ways. So God is teaching all of us an awful lot of responsibility here. And when people study the law of God, even though physical things, you know, we don't do certain things, the spiritual or the spirit of the law is still there to this very day. And it also teaches us the nature of God, and all to teach us to behave ourselves among ourselves and love one another, not hate one another. These are all actions of hatred. A lot of people are full of a nature of hatred without even realizing it. You know, they think, well, I'm doing well, I'm okay. And then, you know, they open their mouth and then insult the brother. No, we're not okay when we do that. We're murderers. You see, as God said later on in the Spirit, he that hates his brother is a murderer. You see? Not even killing him, just hating. So you can see the emotional and the psychological and the spiritual aspects are just as severe as the physical, if not more. And so this is what we read here. And verse 28 now, beside the people themselves, what they do to each other, now the property of the people, what they're responsible for. Verse 28, and if an ox gore a man or a woman, and if they die, the ox shall be surely stoned, and its flesh shall not be eaten. That's how God said it. You see, an ox like that, don't even eat it. You know, it's sort of eating a murderer. But the owner of the ox shall be quit. You see, in other words, if it happened on an occasion, you know, not something that happens all the time. Well, obviously, in this case, the penalty is different. Anyway, we're going to stop at this point. And this is again Mordecai Joseph, greetings to all of God's people. Until next time.